Perfect. Okay, and so we're back up, and I'm going to just start with this silly little quote here. I have a slow down. You move too fast. You got to make the morning last. That was the moment.
No, the
it's
morning.
The morning. Got to make the morning last. Okay. From Simon and Garfunkel, and I didn't know what it is. I thought the song was called "Feeling Groovy," but it's the 59th Street Bridge song. Who knew?
And slowing down is the most important thing you can do. So let's just get into that whole thing about changing behaviors.
Okay. We have the first bit of information we've got is a couple little starters, and it's from the Map of Fleet Fuel Survey. And I don't know that anyone who was, if anyone was on the water in 2008, this probably isn't a great shock to you. But you know, we were able to quantify a lot of the things that were going on out there for folks. Just a couple quick tidbits: 88% of the people fishing changed the way they fish because of the high fuel costs. 70% paid lots of attention to fuel savings, and of course there was a significant interest in technology improvements. And some of the things I thought, Greg, that struck me was how much this actually impacted people's incomes. You know, here's one. Almost 90% of survey respondents indicated their fuel costs as a percentage of income increased either, quote, somewhat more or more than doubled over the past 5 years. So, you know, I don't know that it's simply a phenomenon from last summer, although that was very extreme. But I would expect that it will continue to be a major cost component for anyone fishing. And so to take the time to try to save some money is a good idea.
Yeah, even though we've had moderation in terms of cost of diesel since the financial crisis has hit, and that's obviously affecting, you know, world markets for oil, I think it's fair to say that, you know, over time we're going to see, as we see an economic recovery, we'll see the price of crude drive back up, and that's going to drive diesel prices up. Hopefully not to the extreme level that they were last year, at least not anytime soon. But I think that's an inevitable sort of structural change that we're seeing in the world petroleum markets. So even though we're getting some relief right now, now's the time probably to keep thinking about ways to economize on fuel. So we said that the most important thing you can do is slow down. So that's a basic fundamental change in behavior. And throttling back from hull speed, we're talking now about displacement boats, but one of those Australian studies that we had posted there did an example that throttling back about 10% from hull speed could save 40% or more on fuel. And those were, you know, typical, that was for a fishing vessel of the type that we, or size that we typically see in Alaska. I think it was around a 15-meter boat, so mm-hmm. around 50 plus feet. For semi-displacement and planing hulls, the general rule still holds, although it's not as absolute as for displacement hulls. But the rule is simply slowing down saves fuel and money.
So what's happening there when you slow down? What's the physics behind that?
Well, there's basically three components of your hull that and pushing it through the water that cause drag. There's the viscous drag of the liquid that you're pushing it through. There's the physical drag of the hull itself, and then there's the wave-making drag. Mm-hmm. And the wave-making drag is what you notice when you get to hull speed, and that's when you see a big wave beside the boat. And wave-making drag, viscous drag doesn't really increase much as you go faster, but wave-making drag increases dramatically. It increases almost exponentially to the point that you reach a point where you simply have an infinite requirement for power in order to go faster. And, you know, pouring on the coals doesn't get you any more speed. So backing off a little bit from hull speed, you sacrifice a little bit of time on the water, but you can save a whole lot on fuel.
Okay, so and you were walking me through even the 101s on this displacement hulls versus semi-displacement hulls, or displacement hulls are fully in the water, and you're not going to get those up out of it, so really the only difference
right.
you're going to make is the wave creation
right.
that you're doing.
Right.
Okay.
And a semi-displacement hull, which would be like a lot of Bristol Bay or other gill netters, you know, by adding a whole lot more power, you can get them to plane just a little bit, mm-hmm. which means they'll go a little faster than hull speed, and certainly for those boats too, throttling back really saves money. Sometimes for a fully planing haul, the issue there is a little bit different because you may lose enough speed that you're actually losing fuel economy. But generally speaking, mm-hmm. if you're going 25 knots, planing along really at high speed, and you can still plane at 20,
right.
you'll save a lot of money by backing off to 20.
Gotcha. So, okay.
So the general rule holds for everybody. And asking about haul speed, here's an Alaska Limit Seiner, a Delta, generating. It looks like he's tanked down. Probably he's set up as a longliner there, but he's approaching haul speed, and it's that deep wave that you see beside the boat. It's an indication that he's near.
Okay.
Near hull speed.
What does hull speed refer to?
Hull speed is the theoretical maximum you can drive the hull.
Oh, okay. Okay, gotcha.
So the next fundamental thing you can do is do a little route planning ahead of time. take advantage of the wind and tide. It used to be that everybody had to leave port on the tide when in the sailing ship days. And when engines were sort of rudimentary, the days of cheap power meant it didn't really matter so much, but now it does because of the price of fuel. So if you leave early, go a little slower, plan your route to take advantage of currents and tides, you can actually save a lot of money.
So what you're saying is if you're going out for a noon fishery, maybe plan a little breakfast on the boat, get some coffee, and just maybe head out at 6 a.m.
Exactly.
Instead of 11 a.m.
And, you know, you really see this. Like here in Juneau, we have a fishery, a gillnet fishery, south of town at Taku River, and it's only about 7-8 miles down there. And it used to be that, you know, an hour before the opening, you'd see guys streaming out of town, full mm-hmm. tilt boogie. Now you see a lot of them leaving much earlier, going really slow, and like you say, probably having breakfast on the boat.
Not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea. And they still get there in time to get their favorite spot.
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, this is just, the whole idea of, planning out your route carefully. And I think a lot of the new navigation tools have even current maps on them. So that can help you a lot, too.
Pretty helpful. Okay.
Yeah for sure. excess weight. All right, excess weight reduces freeboard, and that's both a safety and efficiency problem. On that Australian study that I mentioned, they did a test and found that I forget the exact numbers on it, but a certain weight change would cause up to a 2% change in fuel economy. So what you can do is plan your fuel loads, plan your water loads, things like that. Sure. If you don't need to run full tanks, it might save you money. Now, some boats actually run more efficiently tank down, but that's not generally true.
Well, how would you know? How could you determine that?
We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
One of the key things is keeping records. So there are some particularities of every boat, and the only way you're ever going to know is by keeping records.
Okay.
But generally speaking, reducing weight is a good idea. It's also a safety factor. Boats tend to accumulate stuff on deck. And a lot of times, when boats are lost, it's because of stability problems that have emerged as people added more and more and more stuff on deck. Here's a couple of little drawings from Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans that just sort of illustrate this. And, it's just a generally good management practice to keep clutter off the deck, reduce weight.
Right.
And it can save you money. Electrical usage. This is something we don't tend to think about too much, but there are possibilities for making some gains here. If you're running gensets, like if you're running refrigeration or if you have power on the boat using a lot of 110 power, can you get by with a smaller genset? A lot of boats were equipped, say, with a 40 kW genset to run their RSW system, which they may need, but have since added an extra genset, say, a 8 or a 10 kW, just take care of their 110 power needs in the boat when they're not running the RSW. So if you haven't done that, that's one thing you can do, mm-hmm. so you don't have to run the big genset all the time. Another possibility is to add a much larger alternator to your main engine. This will work for some people in some cases so that you can reduce genset use. It's the kind of thing that you really need to have electrical loads checked by an expert and get some good advice from your electrician. Mm-hmm. But it's not as big a saving as throttling back, but it's one of those fine-tuning things that you can do to some effect.
While you're at it, check out that area, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So you mentioned how you're going to know about these things. Well, keep a log. Sorry for the silly slide, but I kind of like this. I couldn't find many interesting log books. So obviously you don't need to keep a log like those guys are doing on the top there.
Right.
But keeping a fuel log and keeping track of your fuel usage, particularly as you make changes in your behavior or how you're running your engine, this type of thing, will help you assess over time, you know, what works mm-hmm. for you and really contributes and what doesn't.
I could say this kind of thing actually works. This is more of a personal example and kind of silly, but back in my bachelor days, at one point I decided to log in all my checks and see what I was spending my money on, and realized I'd spent over $1,000 at this one particular pizza parlor in town, you know, and I realized how gross that was. And so you can believe that I quit doing that. And I know it's a silly example, it's not exactly on point, but you may think you know what you're up to, you may think you know your usage of certain things, but it really helps to go ahead and take a minute to find out.
To highlight those odd behaviors.
Yeah,
right?
Like it changed my behavior.
Too much pizza.
Yeah, too much pizza and beer.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, and it's amazing. You'll find that you have bad habits, almost for sure.
Yeah.
Just keeping a log can help you correct your bad habits. So, it may also prompt you to think about particular savings ideas, and it'll certainly determine your fuel use patterns. Okay, next thing is getting down to good maintenance practices. The main thing that you can do is keep your hull clean. A foul bottom really slows you down and increases fuel consumption. And I've seen some boats that had so many mussels and things growing on the bottom, and they probably needed a shellfish grower's permit to operate. You know, I mean, they were really ugly. And that can really slow you down a lot. And even a fairly light barnacle growth should be removed. And here's an example of pretty bad fouling on the left. And you can see it looks like a limit seiner-sized boat or somewhere in that range. And you can see there's a lot of junk growing on there.
Right.
But even a rather light barnacle growth on the lower right-hand picture is something that you really need to pay attention to.
It was once a year at least?
Yeah, and in some places, I was talking to those guys from Carolina about this, and they have big, big problems down in their area. Mm-hmm. Growth is fast. So
right.
They have, you know, even if you can't get hauled out, you can have a diver. Or if you can just scrape off the visible stuff, that helps, even if you can't get down around the turn of the bilge.
Anything.
But do what you can to keep the bottom clean.
Well, is there, and you talked also about using the right kind of paint to make it more efficient. Is there a paint that not only helps you smooth things out, but reduces the growth?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are anti-fouling paints that, mm-hmm. that inhibit growth.
Okay.
And actually, smoother paint can make a difference. That Australian study, again, found that even the normal roughness, I think it was 250 micron roughness of a good paint job is sufficient to cause about a 1% difference in fuel economy. Now, you may not want to get down to the point of polishing up your bottom that much, but running a good anti-fouling paint and then keeping the bottom cleaned is a good idea. And it's probably worth it to go ahead and hire a diver if you can't haul out.
Right.
Given year.
It's kind of like those shark suits they're making for swimmers now. Make them go a couple seconds faster.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a big saver. Another good indicator is of how you're performing is engine smoke. And if you're spewing an awful lot of black heavy smoke, that's an indication of an overloaded, inefficient engine. Typically, that's caused by a poorly pitched or improperly sized propeller. If you're running white smoke, you've got a water leak and you're getting water into the cylinders. And if it's blue smoke, you're leaking oil in there.
Hmm.
So you should have just a normal light, fairly clear smoke.
Grayish.
Yeah, something you can see through without too much opacity. So if it's black, you're overloaded. If it's blue, you're leaking oil. If it's white, you're leaking water into the engine.
Okay.
So any of those things is going to cause you to be less efficient fuel-wise, but particularly if you're, you know, water leaks and oil leaks indicate you've got a major maintenance problem with your engine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we were talking about props there. Speaking of props, you should really check your propeller for damage. It's basically two types of damage that you're going to run into. There's impact damage and cavitation erosion, both of which cause inefficiency and cost you money. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of pretty gross pictures. Obviously, that's pretty bad impact damage on the top.
Okay, so
propeller is probably beyond repair.
Right.
But that's an egregious example. I don't know what they ran into with that. But
looks like someone took a sledgehammer to it.
Yeah, it's not going to be very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
But cavitation erosion, which is just caused by the air bubbles that are created by the water flow around the prop, can eventually erode a propeller rather severely, and cause balance problems and efficiency problems with the prop. So a poorly tuned prop, when it's damaged, can cost you an awful lot in terms of fuel.
You were telling me that the air bubbles sort of act as, what are they, almost act like grains of sand? Chip away at the propeller?
Well, actually, each time you form a bubble coming off a prop trailing edge, it's like a little explosion.
Uh-huh.
Underwater and, uh-huh. and takes you know, a few molecules of the prop with it. So if you've got bad cavitation, it's pretty hard to avoid cavitation entirely, but bad cavitation can be a real problem. Again, usually bad cavitation is caused by an improperly pitched or tuned prop.
Is this a good time to talk about pitching one's prop, or is it...
Yeah, sure.
How do you know what pitch to put it at? What do you
Well, again, the black smoke is a good indicator, and pitching a prop is it's a bit of an art as well, mm-hmm. as a science. So you really have to talk to a pro.
Okay. And based on the size of your boat, what its weight is.
Yeah, what kind of loads you're putting on it, how you're running it.
Okay.
And different. No single prop usually will meet all of your needs unless you can afford a controllable pitch propeller,
right,
which allows you to pitch your prop as you need it. And that's actually a good thing to do if you can afford it, because then you can basically run your engine at an ideal speed,
mm-hmm.
and just pitch the prop for the amount of thrust that you need.
Yeah, okay.
But other props, and you know, if you've got a fixed pitch prop, it's going to be a compromise to some degree between running speed, towing speed, things like that.
Okay.
So another good maintenance thing is to check your autopilot. A well-tuned pilot is going to hold a straight and steady course, and if you're hunting around, that's bad. If you're always looking for a straight course, every time you do a turn, mm-hmm. you're scrubbing off a little speed, which you've got to compensate for by burning more fuel. And that adds up over time. And it can also be, anybody's had a bad autopilot knows it can be really irritating trying to run a steady course and you're just snaking all over the place, and it's irritating,
right.
and uncomfortable. So have your autopilot properly tuned. If you can't dial it in yourself, most of them have correction mechanisms in them. If you can't dial it in yourself, have your electronics guy do it.
Mm-hmm. Seems like a simple fix.
Yeah, it's not huge savings, but all these things add up.
Right.
All right, so now we're going to get into some technology solutions. One thing everybody's talking about now is new engines, you know, the cleaner, lighter, efficient, they call Tier 3 diesel main engines. Tier 3 is a category of engine that categorization is put out by the Environmental Protection Agency, highest level being Tier 4. All marine diesels have to go to Tier 3. All new ones have to. And even if you're rebuilding one, I think over 750 horsepower, you'll have to bring it up to Tier 3 standards when you rebuild.
Hmm.
So, and that can mean putting on extra different fuel injection, things like that. So the new engines have technologies like common rail fuel injection, electronic controls for fuel pumps and that sort of thing. And they are considerably more efficient. But a lot of the claims that you hear in the fishing press of people making, you know, 50% improvements, that's unrealistic. We're really talking about incremental, though important, changes compared to previous generations of engines. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a really beat-up old two-stroke, it might be worthwhile to swap out. But before you, when you look at swapping an engine, you've got to look at all of the costs. Can you use the existing reduction gear? Do you have to change the engine mounts? All of these things add up. So you have to price out the entire package. You may even need a new propeller.
So I'm just throwing this out there, but from talking to folks, I'd say a new engine, a new rebuild, or not rebuild, but a new engine and all the work that goes to it might be upwards of $50,000.
Oh, easily.
Easily, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it could be less for a small engine, but you know, if you're looking at replacing the main engine on a 58-foot limit seiner, for instance, here, these days you're probably in the close to $100,000 range.
Yeah, right.
So it can really add up fast, and it takes a long time to pay that off with 3 or 4, maybe 5% fuel savings.
Yeah. Now, is it the 20-year life, 30-year life on these buggers? What's the?
Well, yeah, you think of it in terms of hours, actually. Mm, you know, okay. 20 to 25,000 hours between rebuilds. Now, if you've got like a late 80s, early 90s diesel that's getting the high hours and you need to rebuild it, mm-hmm. probably your best bet is an in-frame rebuild. And just have the engine really closely tuned.
Right.
Make sure you got good new injectors and that sort of thing. And that's probably your best bet. But if you do want to swap out, you should be on the lookout for this new state loan program that should be coming out. I think it's due to get legislative approval fairly soon. And the State Division of Investments, I believe they're going to be offering similar to their product quality improvement loans, that is 2% below prime.
Oh, really? So, yeah, it's the low rate. Okay.
Yeah, so it'll be a special rate. So that's good. That helps out.
Yeah, that's the Alaska Division of Investments. We'll have that. Yep.
A couple of other things you can think about. You know, maybe a new genset. You can get gensets with more efficient engines. And like I said earlier, check out the sizing of your genset. Make sure it's not too big for what you need to do. Mm-hmm. You don't want it too small either. Then you overload it. But again, I think that would probably be eligible for the new state program as well. A couple of other things that are worth thinking about. One is a fuel flow meter. They're not too expensive. Depending on your installation, a few hundred to maybe $1,500 gives you real-time fuel consumption data. That higher figure is basically for having one that's really fine-tuned to your system by a pro.
Okay.
The actual gauges themselves aren't all that expensive, but the installation can be a little complex. But again, this is one of those things where you can actually really see what you're doing, and that is the best thing for keying you how to slow down. So you can experiment then with the revolutions per minute on your engine and dial it in for just the best possible fuel flow.
So if you're gonna be keeping track of your records and doing the logbook, you might as well save yourself some hassle and get one of these things installed,
right?
And then really fine tune it,
right.
See what you're doing.
Exactly.
See how you run with the weight. Maybe that might help with your pitch determination and things like that.
It helps you optimize look at all your optimization things. And then when you play with something, mm-hmm. whether it's the speed you're going or a new piece of equipment, you can really see exactly what effects there are.
Okay.
Another thing which wasn't shown in there is a stack pyrometer. I don't know what percentage of guys are running stack pyrometers, but that measures the heat of your exhaust, and is another good wheelhouse instrument to have that'll tell you how you're performing.
Okay.
It's also good to warn you of any engine problems. I mean, if you're running normally at say 750. Degrees on your stack pyrometer, and all other things are the same, and suddenly the heat of your exhaust shoots up to 900 or mm-hmm. 1,000 degrees, you know you got a problem. Something's wrong with the engine. So it's a good early warning alert too.
Is that like a more sophisticated test than the visually looking into your exhaust? Is it going to tell you roughly the same kind of thing?
No, not exactly. It'll tell you how efficiently you're running now.
Okay.
So okay. It more or less goes along with the flow meter, mm-hmm. I would say.
Okay,
so some other tech solutions, bulbous bows. Not something you see on a lot of boats in Alaska, but they're more common. Bulbous bows basically improve the efficiency of the water flow around the vessel. And they can dramatically reduce fuel consumption for vessels that are running at continuous cruising speeds for long, mm-hmm. long distances. That's why you'll never see like a large tanker or container vessel built these days that doesn't have bulbous bows, because particularly for that type of operation, they really make dramatic savings, up to 15% on fuel versus a standard bow.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be more effective on larger displacement boats, but even smaller craft can benefit. They also, as I said, are most important for continuous cruising operations, but fishing vessels can benefit from them too, particularly if you're doing a lot of running mm-hmm. between places. and they're not just for small boats anymore. The other thing that they do is they can improve your seakeeping. That doesn't necessarily save you much in fuel, although by dampening pitching motions, it can actually help save fuel, but it can make a boat ride better and be more comfortable.
I was going to ask you.
So there's two sets of benefits there, fuel saving and comfort.
Yeah? Does it help stability too?
Well, I didn't think it helps the overall stability, but it helps helps dampen pitching motion on vessels.
Okay.
Like I said, they're not just for big boats anymore. Here's three examples. We got the chart there that just shows how bulbous bows affect the wave making around the front of a boat. On the bottom there is an Alaska limit seine, or again a delta, that's had a bulbous bow of a standard shape added by Platypus Marine in Port Angeles. They've done a number of these, and apparently they help out quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a fiberglass boat. They're fairly easy to mold on. Steel is also fairly easy to work with. If you got a wood boat, forget it. I don't think these are going to – a bulbous bow is for you. This – the one you see on the Alaskan Lady there is a conventional shape.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of guys do with steel boats is they'll buy a large propane tank.
Right.
And fit one end of it to it, and that cylindrical shape – works pretty well. It may not be the absolute ideal shape. Again, the shaping of bulbous bows is a bit of a black art, and if you wanted to get the ideal shape, it's a series of compromises, and again, you'd need to be talking to a naval architect, but using one of these basic shapes probably has a lot of the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
And the Icelanders now are even putting them on fairly high-speed boats. You see that vessel up in the top right there?
Right.
That's one of their high-speed nearshore fishing vessels. They're basically designed to run out to the grounds quickly.
Mm-hmm.
At full load, they can't plane. So they come back, and in that mode, the bulbous bow helps. And apparently, they actually help also even at high speeds in terms of pitching and not diving too much when they go over a good wave. So bulbs are not just for big displacement hulls anymore.
So is the physics behind this? It pushes the water out of the way of the hull.
In a way, it changes the wave shape along the boat.
Changes.
And as
the
we
wave
talked
shape.
About earlier, wave shape is generating that wave is the big fuel coster in displacement hulls particularly.
Okay.
So by altering the wave shape, you basically create a wave that's a little easier and more efficient to generate.
Right. So if you got a 58-foot seine steel boat, what are you looking at? 20, 30, 40,000 to?
Yeah, it's going to depend on the particulars of the installation, but that's, I would say on a boat like that, you're looking at, depending on exactly what you do, anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 for a retrofit.
Yeah.
So it's something you have to carefully consider, but if you're doing a lot of running, like I said, at running speeds, you can easily save on a fishing boat's hull, perhaps 10%, and overall you might save 3% to 5% on your operations.
Okay.
So, over time it certainly adds up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's something that most people don't think too much about, and that's aerofoil rudder. airfoil, actually, and flap rudders. Most people, most rudders on fishing boats are flat stock rudders, just a piece of steel,
and, okay, right.
You know, and that's it. By going to an airfoil shape, two things happen. The flat, it's more efficient in terms of drag than a flat rudder. And it also, so that helps improve fuel economy. And it can make a couple of percentage points difference. But it also improves steering and maneuverability because an aerofoil rudder creates more lift. That is, in imagine, for instance, if you got on a 737, mm-hmm. and instead of having an aerofoil-shaped wing, it just had a flat
wing.
Piece of steel out there, you'd right. say, this doesn't look too good because it's not very efficient. So the aerofoil creates more lift. In an airplane, of course, that makes you go up. But a rudder, basically, it's side forces.
I see.
So that when we talk about lift there, it's in terms of generating side forces, which improve steering and maneuverability.
It turns you quicker, therefore you use less fuel to make the turn?
That too, yeah. So, and in straight running, it creates less drag. And in turning situations, it doesn't have to turn as much to generate the same side force. So
right.
You have less drag, less turbulence.
So pardon me for interrupting here, but the aerofoil, what is that referring to? Is that the material?
No, that's referring to the shape.
The shape.
As opposed to flat stock.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
The shapes that are used are what they call NACA profiles. That's the National Aeronautic...
Something else, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And a lot of them were developed back in the 30s when they first started looking at airplane wings.
Mm-hmm.
But those same shapes work in a hydrodynamic environment.
Okay.
So here's a flap rudder. Now what a flap rudder does is it puts a movable or steerable flap on the back edge of the rudder to further increase its turning efficiency.
Okay.
Now this is not going to create much change in terms of fuel efficiency directly, but it'll really dramatically improve your maneuverability.
And this is controlled in the wheelhouse. That extra little flap.
No, it's actually, they're generally mechanically controlled at the rudder. So in other words, as you turn it, as you turn the rudder,
okay.
the flap begins to turn more and more.
I got you. Right.
So it's not an extra thing to control. It's automatic.
Oh, that's nice.
And there you see one on the right.
Okay.
And they're basically mechanically operated by the rudder design.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. I think I don't have another picture of those, but they're not just for big boats, although they're standard items on large vessels, but there are several companies in the Northwest that make flap rudders for vessels, cruising boats, and fishing boats.
I wouldn't think they're too terribly expensive in a whole
they're
scope
not.
Of things.
I talked to a chap from one of those companies a couple of years ago at Fish Expo, and... He was, mind you, he was trying to sell them, but he was suggesting at that point in time that they pay for themselves in about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, and given the greater maneuverability they offer, that's a big plus between the fuel savings and the maneuverability.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll come back to that item when talking about court nozzles.
Okay.
Court nozzles. I see we misspelled it on the top level there, but court nozzles were developed by a German whose name was Kort, surprisingly enough, back in the 1920s. And basically they're a duct that goes around the propeller that ducts the water flow so you don't lose power off the tips of the propeller blades. They can give up to 25% more thrust, sometimes even more, but 25% is fairly common. For the same power, or you can use that gain to save fuel. In other words, you get the same thrust for 25% less.
Mm-hmm.
They have traditionally been seen as most useful for vessels that are under heavy loads at relatively low speeds, like trawlers or tugboats. But they've been gradually refined with different shapes over the years, so that now they're used in higher speed operations too. And one of the problems with the old designs was that the drag created by the nozzle itself, and I'll show you a picture of one, the drag created by the nozzle structure basically at some point in time sort of overcame the thrust advantages.
Mm-hmm.
But by carefully tuning the shapes of these things, they've got them so that even at at cruising speeds for vessels, they're resulting in improvements. Like, you know, you actually get improved speed. There's one company in Alabama called Rice Propeller, and they design integrated propeller systems with nozzles, and they have one called a speed nozzle, which is basically designed for higher speed operation. Now, when I'm talking about higher speed, I'm not talking about outboard engines. We're talking about displacement hulls. But here's kind of the ultimate setup here. You've got a vessel with a controllable pitch propeller inside a cork nozzle.
Right.
With aerofoil flap rudder.
Yeah.
So I'll go back to that aerofoil flap rudder. One of the problems with cork nozzles is they kind of reduce your maneuverability, particularly when backing down.
Okay.
So I was talking to one of those South Carolina shrimpers the other day, and he had a nozzle on his, and he said, boy, it's really, really hard when you're in port. He says, mm-hmm. It doesn't want to move. But I encourage them to go back to the manufacturer and look at an airfoil rudder to improve his steering mm-hmm. at low speeds.
So it looks to me, as a sort of layman kind of running at this one, that it basically it funnels the water and funnels the energy from the propeller.
Yes, it does. Just like, I mean, it's the same principle as a jet engine.
Yeah.
Funneling in. You see the large mouth on a 747 engine versus a small tail. I mean, it controls the thrust and makes it more efficient.
Yeah, because I guess it'd be sort of like blowing air through a big cylinder versus a small one. If you can bring it down, it's going to make a more fine and powerful.
It's the Venturi effect.
Yeah. And okay.
To speak technically, and okay. we all know about it in a lot of instruments and whatnot. And
okay.
Definitely, really, really works. One of the problems some people don't like it because of the potential for fouling with nets and things like that. And that's true. I would say that these aren't for everybody. If you're longlining or gill netting, something like that, it's mm-hmm. probably not as important. But certainly, if you're a dragger,
yeah,
definitely
you want to
have a cork nozzle.
Yeah.
Okay. So, geez, we're whipping through this. Anybody out there got any questions?
Yeah, we're doing
call
okay.
Call in any time. last year when fuel prices got so horrendously high, I started working I started researching ideas that are out there for alternative fuels. You know, what's the future of diesel?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when it was $4.50, $5 a gallon, the future looked pretty darn bleak, to tell you the truth. So,
right.
You know, there are alternatives to running diesel engines. I don't know if any of you, I'm probably dating myself here, but way back in the early 60s, the U.S. government came out with a freighter called the Savannah that was powered by a nuclear engine,
mm-hmm.
a nuclear reactor, and pretty darn efficient. But I think we can probably rule it out for fishing vessels.
Well, it wasn't quickly hijacked by a Central American country, was it?
Yeah, exactly. You want to worry about those things. So mm-hmm. I think that security reasons, upfront costs, and so forth, pretty well rule it out, even though it's technically feasible. I mean, I'm sure you could probably put a nuclear power plant on one of these big factory trawlers. But, you'd need a highly trained engineer.
Yes,
for sure.
You would need a highly trained engineer.
So there has been some buzz about hydrogen. In fact, the Icelanders supposedly have a project on the books to do a hydrogen-powered fishing vessel, a 750-horsepower vessel that they want to have minimum 4 days endurance. So it's what they would be doing is they would be running fuel cells with the hydrogen. But there's a lot of problems with hydrogen. But first of all, let's talk about the benefit. When you burn hydrogen, basically your exhaust is water because
mm-hmm.
it combines with oxygen and, you know, you end up with H2O. It doesn't get much cleaner than that. I mean, if we could all just, you know, run our cars and just simply exhaust water, we'd be in great shape.
Roads would be a little slicker, but
might be in the winter, yeah.
Right.
That's something that I don't think they've crossed that hurdle
yet. Haven't had to worry about that yet. Well,
but,
fair enough.
You know, but we might have to think about it. So there's been a lot of interest in hydrogen. The problem with hydrogen is that it doesn't exist in a natural form. You can't mm-hmm. drill for it and pump it out of the ground. I mean, it exists as water, so mainly on Earth. So what you've got to do is you've got to split it from the oxygen, first of all, and that takes more energy than you get back. Yeah, it might pencil out in a place like Iceland where they've got enormous amounts of geothermal and hydropower that's essentially free, and they can do this, and they've got a certain type of society and where they can make changes, and it's a relatively small country, but I don't see it in our future.
Right. So you'd burn more diesel breaking it apart than you would saving it.
Yeah. So it's probably not in our future. Mm-hmm. Plus, there's big problems with economical production, distribution infrastructure. One report that I read was thinking that to recreate hydrogen infrastructure, distribution infrastructure, might cost over $1 trillion. Of course, I realize that's chicken feed these days. We're giving that much to AIG executives, but not really. But it's a big, big cost. Plus, there's safe and efficient storage issues. And in order to use hydrogen at all, it's very much less energy dense than diesel. In other words, for if you had a gallon of liquid hydrogen, it would only produce less than half the energy of a gallon of petrodiesel.
Is it the same size? It would be different size than a gallon of fuel.
Yeah, a gallon's a volumetric measure.
Yes, okay.
So the same volume produces about half the energy. So that's what we're talking about, volumetric energy density. And in order to get liquid hydrogen, stored, you have to have a very, very special pressure vessel. Mm-hmm. And if something goes wrong with it, you can have major, major problems. So it doesn't look like hydrogen, because of the shape of the tanks and things like that, I don't think it's a practical thing for boats.
We simply aren't there.
We simply aren't there. Now, there are alternatives, what they call metal hydrides, which are, I shouldn't get too far into that because I don't know exactly what they are.
Okay.
But they're basically a method of binding hydrogen atoms to a metallic hydride that then can be released and burned in a fuel cell.
Huh.
Now, those potentially have the ability to solve some of those storage problems, but they're expensive and bulky.
Right.
So.
Okay.
However, there's the world's first hydrogen fuel station, and it's near Reykjavik in Iceland.
And they put it in English, too, for us.
They
did.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It works, but I wouldn't hold your breath for the fishing fleet.
Okay.
So there are some other alternatives, though. One is biodiesel. Now, biodiesel burns just like petrodiesel. Petrodiesel meaning diesel is derived from the rocks, the stuff we pump out of the ground. So biodiesel is not quite as energy dense as petrodiesel, but it's really close.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it's a little slippery. It has better lubricity. So that compensates. You actually get better engine life with biodiesel. And in theory, it can be really green because, in theory, you can produce it with zero net carbon because you're basically capturing sunlight with photosynthesis and then converting that biomass to diesel.
Mm-hmm.
Another beauty of it is it can use existing infrastructure. Matter of fact, it does use existing infrastructure. Biodiesel's out there now. Most of what's being produced is being produced from soy, and some other crops. I think biodiesel production last year was about 0.5% of all of the diesel consumed.
Right.
But you can mix it with petrodiesel or run it 100%, and it works straight up in existing engines.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you don't have that $1 trillion cost for
new distribution infrastructure. Right.
People use their same engines and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the problem with conventional biodiesel, the way it's going now, is that it's competing with food production because it's using arable land.
Mm-hmm.
So those soybeans or whatever you're turning into biodiesel, it's kind of like the ethanol problem.
Right.
It makes a fuel, but you could be feeding people, so that creates an ethical problem.
Is it pretty expensive, too?
A gallon
of... Or is it so subsidized at this point we really can't get a handle on it?
It's... When petrodiesel is around $75 a gallon, then biodiesel is...
$75 a barrel.
$75 a barrel, excuse me. When crude oil is $75 a barrel, then biodiesel is pretty competitive.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And even less than that. in some instances.
Okay.
But the last line there is about algae, and algae is real interesting. First of all, it's your common ordinary pond scum.
Mm-hmm.
But some strains of algae can be up to 50% oil.
Uh-huh.
And it's vegetable oil can be converted into diesel oil,
mm-hmm,
with something they call a transesterification.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
actually, it took a little practice to get that one out.
But,
I was standing in front of the mirror last night trying to say transesterification.
Well done.
The beauty of algae is that it has much, much greater potential per acre than crops like soy or even palm kernel oil, which is more efficient than soy. Soy, you can produce 45 to 50 gallons per acre. The theoretical potential of algae is up to 50,000 gallons per acre.
Right.
Now, in practical terms, it's much less than that for a variety of reasons, but practical levels can still be 100 times as great as soy. It can be 5,000 gallons per acre.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a few pictures. The blue-green algae we're talking about is that little critter in the upper right-hand corner. A real humble plant.
Mm-hmm.
About the most humble of plants.
Right.
To get it actually producing efficiently, what they need to do is go through a two-stage process. And the problem with algae is that it gets degraded. Algae cultures get degraded by other algae that blow in off the winds that aren't as efficient. So you want these ones that are producing 50% oil,
right,
not the ones that produce 5% oil. So to keep the culture clean, they raise them in, they're raising them now in things called photobioreactors. There's an example of one on the left, which allow optimum use of light, and they keep the culture pure.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the process, what they do is they go through an oil concentration stage. They produce more oil when they're starved for food.
Okay.
So what they do is then they release the critters into a pond that's limited in its food availability, and they add a lot of oil.
Mm.
And that's too late in the process to get the culture contaminated. So that's the way they're doing it now. And the stuff looks and smells pretty much like conventional diesel and burns the same way. So this may be the fuel of the future.
See that little your picture there on the left, upper left. I could see that some smaller scale of that is stuck on in every engine in the future. Sort of, it's your own little algae plant that you've got cranking away on things. So, interesting. Okay, well it's still a ways out though, I'd imagine. But
technology works now. What they're doing is they're in the process of refining the process to a point of being really economical.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to a chap who did a major study on this for the University of New Hampshire, and he figures they're competitive at crude oil at about $85, and he thinks that number will drop to $45 per barrel.
Right.
Competitive level within 2 or 3 years.
Sure.
There's several hundred companies working on this now. So it's a proven technology. You actually make the oil. It works. So it's just a question of scale, probably.
Yeah, right. Oh, good. So. Very interesting. Well, all of these things all together incrementally can have a cost, but they have a potential to lower the fishing fuel bill. Well, thanks. I think that's probably the brunt of what we have today.
It is. That's the last slide.
No problem. Well, we've cut a little bit short today, but if anyone wants to get a hold of you, Greg, how do they contact you? If you like.
Well, I'm not on the MAP website, but you can contact me at 907-586-4090.
Okay.
Or by email at prawns, which is just like it sounds, PRAWNS, at alaska.net.
Okay, yeah.
And be happy to kick around ideas with anybody who wants to call in.
That's right. So. Sounds great. Well, I don't think we have anyone calling in or dialing in on the various servers, but so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Great.
Glenn.
Appreciate it.
I wish if somebody's out there and has any questions, give us a shout. Otherwise, we'll be dialing off here pretty soon.
Okay. Thanks.
Maybe buy biodiesel futures.
Yeah, that'd be good.